Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right. From the BBC, flights were canceled in Japan after scissors go missing.
Okay.
It's been a rough summer for travel, especially flights.
Yes,
right?
It has. See, last week. Anyway.
But even outside of your normal experience, be grateful, unless you were one of the few caught up in this particular incident, where 36 flights were canceled and 201 were delayed at a Japanese airport on the weekend after a pair of scissors went missing in a store near the boarding gate.
Oh, they weren't even on the plane. They were just in the airport somewhere, and they're like, cancel all flights out of here.
Pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Security checks at Hokkaido's new Chitose Airport domestic terminal were suspended for about 2 hours on this Saturday morning as passengers in the departure lounge were forced to retake security checks.
Oh, wow.
Now, authorities tried to locate the missing scissors, which, are you ready, were found at the same store the following day.
No!
Oh, no. That means an employee had them.
Oh.
Accidentally put them in their pockets.
Oh.
It's like, oh, crap. And then just put them back.
You pretty much nailed it. Yeah, pretty much. So now authorities explained that they held off on making the announcement until they had confirmed that the scissors were in fact the same ones that were lost. But, you know, in very stiff upper lip, I guess, Japanese fashion, I'm mixing my geo metaphors here. But one traveler told local media at the time, I don't think we have any choice but to wait, but I do hope they are a bit more careful about it.
Wow.
And diplomatic. Some said that it reaffirmed their confidence in Japan's air safety.
Yeah, that's a lot of flights, though. Like, good for them for finding the two people who were like, this was necessary and I understand. Because I guarantee you there were at least some people who were like...
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I really hope they're also offered some counseling because the culture of shame in Japan for stuff like this is so intense. So, look, it could happen to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Also, scissors at an airport. Do we really? I mean...
Yeah, what did you need to cut in that store anyway? Like, you know...
Right, or that there's a box opening station prior to security.
Right, but, right. Or, like, in prison, you chain them to the desk. Like, they have tools, but you can't walk away with them.
We chain our pens.
Yeah. Americans chain their pens. Japanese can chain their scissors. Come on.
No. Chaining is a very American way of doing things.
It is.
Japan will probably have a mascot of, like, Scissors-chan. And if you need something cut, you have to summon Scissors-chan, who will come over and cut your thing for you. And who wouldn't want something like that, right?
Honestly, yeah. I'd be down with that.
I'm telling you. It's got some legs. Okay. Next link.
Next link.
Okay. This comes from Ars Technica. That book is poison. Even more Victorian covers found to contain toxic dyes.
Ooh.
Even more? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
We already knew about this.
Yeah. In April, the National Library of France removed 4 19th century books, all published in Great Britain, from its shelves because the covers were likely laced with arsenic.
Oh, dear.
Another gift to the French from the UK.
Right.
Let's see if that was intentional or not. But the books have been placed in quarantine for further analysis to determine exactly how much arsenic. Oh, the Victorians and their toxic chemicals.
I mean,
how naive is what future generations will say of our plastics?
Yeah,
but they were experimenting, right? Like, this was all new to them, too.
And we had a lot of dishware with lead in the 80s, if I recall correctly. So, you know.
Yep, I found out that in utero, my mom was living next to a lead factory. So that explains a lot. And that was 1977, so to your point.
Yeah.
Chemists from Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee, have been also studying Victorian books from their university's library collection in order to identify and quantify levels of poisonous substances in the covers. Using a combination of spectroscopic techniques, They found that several books had lead concentrations more than twice the limit imposed by U.S. Centers of Disease Control.
Mm. Oops.
Yikes. The Lipscomb effort was inspired by the University of Delaware's Poison Book Project, love the name, established in 2019 as an interdisciplinary crowdsourced collaboration between university scientists and the Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library. The initial objective was to analyze all the Victorian era books in the Winterthur collection for the presence of an arsenic compound called copper acetorsinate, an emerald green pigment that was very popular at the time to dye wallpaper, clothing, and cloth book covers, and also covers dyed with yellow chrome, aka lead chromate. By the way, chrome yellow, a favorite of Vincent van Gogh. The Poison Book Project is ongoing, but 50% of the 19th century cloth case bindings tested so far contain lead and cloth across a range of colors, as well as other highly toxic heavy metals, arsenic, chromium, and mercury. However, the project's researchers also determined that, for the moment at least, the chromium and lead in yellow-dyed book covers are still bound in the cloth. So you're okay with those. The emerald green pigment, on the other hand, is highly friable, meaning that the particles break apart under even small amounts of stress or friction, like rubbing or brushing up against the surface, opening the book.
Right, reading a book like you did.
And that pigment dust is then hazardous to humans, particularly when inhaled. They list some recommendations for handling and storing such books, like wear nitrile gloves. Maybe don't bite your fingernails or rub your eyes after handling one.
Just digitize it.
Yeah. Really, you should be thinking about getting rid of it.
Yeah.
Maybe give it to the Goodwill.
No!
Contact the Poison Book Project, maybe.
Right.
So, no good news on this one. So just heads up out there, you librarians, historians, archivists, and book nerds.
Well, a project exists. That's good news.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's green and yellow are the big ones, right? Like, is it other colors too? They said lead was in a lot of colors, right?
A lot of colors. But the lead was at least bound. It's mostly that green colored.
Okay. No green books. That's my new rule.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got one from The Guardian that's kind of about animals, but really about trauma. And it's called The First Rule of Bite Club, Survive an Attack by an Apex Predator.
Wait, what?
Well, so Bite Club isn't just a pun for the headline. It's the real name of a group that provides online community and support for survivors of major animal attacks.
Oh.
It was founded by Dave Pearson from New South Wales, who is himself the survivor of a shark attack. So Pearson's story is he was an avid surfer, and one day about 13 years ago, he was having his, quote, usual after-work surf when a bull shark came up underneath him and hit him like a train. The shark clamped down on his left arm and surfboard, nearly removed his arm entirely, cutting through the bone and leaving it hanging by just the flesh. Yeah, there's a lot of attack stories in this article, and they get real graphic, just FYI. Ooh. Obviously, he did manage to get to shore and survive, though, and doctors were even able to save his arm. And Pearson said at first he felt okay. You know, there was a lot of media attention, maybe some long-term adrenaline. It was only months later that he was suddenly hit with this wave of depression and PTSD. And he said he felt really strongly that no matter how well-meaning his friends or family or even therapists were, no one could truly understand the psychological aftermath if they hadn't gone through an attack themselves.
Fair.
So he found another shark attack survivor online and drove for hours just to sit down and have coffee with the guy and ask questions like, do you still wake up at night screaming? How long is the nerve damage going to last? And he got such relief from the meeting that he started reaching out to more survivors and driving to meet them. And it wasn't long before he was reaching out to brand new victims as well, just to let them know that there were people out there for them when the PTSD eventually hit.
Aww.
Yeah, it's really sweet. This guy's kind of a hero. And it wasn't just an empty promise. Back when the group was still small, Pearson used to call every single member every Friday evening just to check up on them. And one member even told him once that he'd been thinking about taking his own life on a Thursday night, but knew that Pearson was going to call the next day and didn't want to disappoint him.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, by now, of course, the group is much bigger and operates mostly online through their Facebook page, where they have members from around the world. One of those members is a woman named Annika Craney, who says she experienced the same thing Pearson did when it came to the delayed onset of her PTSD. She was bitten on the leg by a shark, and afterwards she went right back to work at her job as a boat captain. It wasn't until a year and a half later that she was out surfing one day and suddenly hallucinated a shark swimming right toward her.
Okay.
Yeah. She said after that, her world fell apart. She would hear people screaming for help, see blood in the water, shark fins that weren't there. And her family couldn't understand how she was suddenly having all these problems now when she'd been fine for more than a year.
She wasn't.
Exactly. But when she found Bike Club, they told her, yeah, that's how it was for all of us too. And thanks to their help, she's been able to finally get through the trauma and is back working on the water once again now. And that's actually something that Pearson does personally if he can. When someone in the group is ready to get back in the water for the first time, he travels down to get in with them. And sometimes even more people come and do it in a big group to support each other.
Yes!
Yeah, so it's really beautiful. And he's quick to point out that it's not just sharks. Bike Club is open to anyone attacked by any kind of apex predator. And they have members who have been attacked by lions, alligators, hippos, bears, you name it. In 2013, they were officially registered as a nonprofit, which is helpful because it allows psychologists and other professionals to help members for free and write it off as a charitable donation.
Nice.
So, you know, the first thing I was thinking was, oh, that woman we talked about, the old lady who got bitten by a mountain lion, she should absolutely hear about this. But I'm also wondering, like, what about the shark's experience? Like, did they have their own support group for the trauma of when your dinner starts punching you in the face? You know? Because they are just animals doing their thing. You can't be angry at them.
That's what causes that suppression, is that it's such a discoherent thought from your worldview and society's worldview that to experience that at like an animal limbic level of like, oh, I can still be prey sometimes.
Right.
So far outside of normal modern human experience.
Yeah, yeah. You've shifted into a prey mindset. You got to put your eyes on the side of your head, just start eating grass. Like, that's what it is for you now. Next link.
All right, let's stay in the animal kingdom, but in a dramatically different emotional turn with Discover Magazine's article, At Its Core, Life is All About Play.
Mm.
It's been a while, right? Adults famously, at least as humans, have trouble getting into moments of play, but the article starts off really connecting play to natural selection, and it has this amazing picture. It's titled The Battle of the Fruit and Vegetable Soldiers, and it's a drawing on the back of a manuscript page from Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. The artwork has been attributed to Darwin's young son, Francis.
Aww.
The drawing shows this turbaned cavalry soldier facing off against an English dragoon. The British soldier sits aside a carrot, and the turbaned soldier rides a grape. And it's like instead of horses, they're vegetables, and they've got little horsey heads and little horsey feet. And it's thought to be the work of this Francis Darwin, the seventh child of Charles Darwin and his wife Emma. And this tracks with Darwin's biographers, who have long recognized that play was important in his personal and familial life. For example, the Georgian manor in which Darwin and his wife raised their 10 children, they had a rope swing over the first floor landing.
Wow.
They even had a portable wooden slide they could lay over the main stairway, which my inner child was like, oh yeah.
My inner adult is going, wooden slide.
Splinters.
Splinters.
Liability lawsuits. Oh no.
Well, indeed, it was a different time. But, you know, that was just inside the house, because outside the gardens and even the surrounding countryside, they effectively served as an open-air laboratory and playground. Now, play also has a role in Darwin's theory of natural selection. To begin with, no goal or no direction. That's kind of what characterizes play, right? In other words, or in Darwin's words, it includes no necessary and universal law of advancement or development. Also, natural selection is open-ended. The forms of play are not fixed, but continually evolve. And that's also characteristic of play, right? Darwin also acknowledged that natural selection is wasteful. Quote, many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive. And they think the same thing about play, right? It requires an animal to expend time and energy that could have been devoted to behaviors like foraging and hunting that could aid survival. But this is a really good impulse, because animals that forage and hunt in specific ways don't typically change. But an animal at play is far more likely to innovate. And some of those innovations may in time be adapted in new ways to forage and hunt. They also see some similarities between natural selection and play employing deception. Butterflies can be colored to resemble toxic species, or wild cats can squeal like distressed baby monkeys. And play, specifically play fighting, gives animals opportunities to learn about and practice this kind of deception.
Well, and then the question is, why after a certain age do we feel silly playing again, unless we're actors?
Yeah.
Well, because if play produces innovation, then if you want obedience, play's got to come off the menu, right?
Yeah. Well, if playing was a choice, people would always choose playing over work. So in order to get people to work, we have to be like, well, play is for children. Play is not for you anymore. And that's the only way our society continues to build cars is because play is for children only.
So if you want to break through from the status quo, if you want to innovate, you better get some play back in your life. And not in that kind of way, but like, you know, play play.
Yeah.
Next link?
Next link. Okay, we'll stay in the realm of play and evolution. This comes from Discover. Why are people ticklish?
I don't know. It seems like a real vulnerability, to be honest.
Yeah, I feel triggered just hearing that. Like, whoop, who's after me now?
There are two kinds of tickles. One that's very hard to pronounce. Nismesis, K-N-I-S-M-E-S-I-S, is a soft, gentle kind of tickling, like when somebody strokes you with a feather or an insect crawls across your skin. But here, we're going to talk about the other kind, which is called gargalesis types of tickling. It's the full-on go-for-the-ribs armpit tickling that makes you laugh out loud and wiggle and squirm, right? And your response, let's stop and think about it for a minute. It's pretty odd about tickling. When you're being tickled, you laugh sometimes a lot. That's a sign of happiness and joy. But you also squirm and try to get away from the tickler. It's still funny, but it's not fun.
Yeah.
Not only that, but it's a different kind of laugh when we're being tickled from when we're hearing like a joke or a funny meme. Those experiences are processed in the frontal lobe, whereas the sensation of being tickled is in the limbic system.
Sorry, I'm just realizing they had to tickle people in an MRI to find that out. Like,
that's exactly right. What I wonder how much they got paid for that. And those emotions can be negative or positive, but the limbic system, again, it's the oldest part of the brain, the fight or flight response. So even though scientists know what happens in the brains when we are tickled because of the MRI, it's still something of a mystery of why we have this response in the first place. One of the common theories is that tickling is a form of social bonding. One of the scientists points out that generally we don't like being tickled by strangers. So tickling may play a developmental role as well. Babies and children are more ticklish than adults, and adults seem eager to tickle them. When babies are born, their sensory systems may need to be trained. So by tickling our young, we may be helping train their nervous system to distinguish between sensations that are safe and those that might be harmful. This could also explain why we're more ticklish around the ribs. It's the area that's our most vulnerable. Being tickled might also help an infant to gradually learn to distinguish self from other, me from mom. So the same kind of touch could be processed completely differently by the brain depending upon the situation. So if you're in a bad mood and or stressed, a friendly tickle might not invoke giggles at all, right? Yeah. Just be irritating.
Yeah, we go straight to fight.
Right. We react often excessively to being tickled by others, but most people can't tickle themselves. This is in part because self-tickling lacks the element of surprise, according to some research. But there's a little more to it than that. Tickling sends a message from the body to the brain, but there's also a descending pathway that can mute the sensation. For example, when we're in a bad mood or aren't comfortable with the person who's doing the tickling, we can mute that. We have a strong body map, so we're controlling the sensation and muting some kind of tickle pathway.
I wonder if there's room for diagnosis of depression or PTSD or things by basically being like, are you able to be tickled? Can someone come up behind you and get you? Or are you just like, And that proves that your downward suppression is just permanently on, regardless of whether this is a family member or anything else.
Yeah.
Or when you're really stressed, right? Because there are times when I am really stressed and my body is really tight and you hit me on the rib and I'm going to squirm.
Yeah, yeah. You're going to squirm, but it's not going to be a happy squirm.
But if I'm really loose and calm and you're hitting me in that same spot, it won't be ticklish, even though I'm in a relaxed state. So there's some interesting brain firings going off with tickling that we still...
And body. Brain and body, like you said.
Yep.
We just need more MRIs, y'all.
Yeah, more tickling. That's what it calls for.
More scientific tickling.
That's right.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, Popular Science has some good news for the space tourism industry, which is that space beer may taste better than Earth beer.
Okay.
What a sell!
If we can get back from space.
Yeah. Well, and they are quick to note that studying fermentation in microgravity does have many important applications for humanity's potential survival in space, but also they had the opportunity to study beer, so of course they did. And to your point, unfortunately, this experimental beer was not actually made in outer space, but rather in an artificial microgravity simulator at the University of Florida. And because the state of Florida is a deeply serious place, they published their results in the scientific journal Beverages. But what they found is pretty interesting. First of all, the test tube mixtures of mashed up barley wort and a fermenting yeast known as Saccharomyces pastorianus were able to ferment significantly faster under the microgravity conditions. So right there, you're getting more beer in less time. Everybody up in space is going to love that. But they also contained significantly lower amounts of two chemicals known as esters, specifically isoamyl acetate and 2-phenethyl acetate. And that's a big deal when it comes to flavor, because esters produce a fruity, banana-like flavor in beer that many drinkers consider undesirable.
Hmm.
And that's admittedly a bit of a judgment call, because some beer brands actually like to lean into this flavor a little. But generally speaking, a lower ester beer is considered a fancier beer. And everyone agrees that past a certain concentration, esters are just gross, right? It's too much of a good thing, even if you like it. So since the microgravity fermentation produced less than a third as many esters as the controls, there's potentially room here for a brewery to start using microgravity simulating machines in their production process simply for the benefits here on Earth. I don't know how expensive one of those is.
What the hell is a microgravity machine? And how are we doing that? That seems pretty remarkable.
They were very vague. They basically, they likened it to a centrifuge. It's basically you are spinning in a certain direction and that momentum is countering gravity. So you just sort of feel more lightweight all the time. And I was like, well, doesn't that just mean gravity has shifted to the outside rather than down? And they did not describe it. But it's, it's a university level machine. Theoretically, it does what it says it does. But I don't know.
Can we use that to lift large objects in the future? I mean,
exactly. There seems to be
make
more
beer
benefits.
Seems like a small...
narrow application.
Yes. Right.
But there must be something I'm missing about the machine. I know there is.
Well, it's just like a giant trample. It's like the vomit comet. They take it up and are just constantly putting in a state of dropping.
Yeah. You don't have the classification to get the rest of those features right now. They're exploring.
There you go. Exactly.
That's right.
Now, the researchers say they don't know why this happened. Their best guess is that the gene responsible for regulating the amount of ester that is produced is somehow affected by weightlessness. And again, it's super important for us to know if certain genes, either in our food supply or ourselves, are turned on or off simply by being in microgravity. They also point out that this is all theoretical in the sense that they were merely testing the chemical makeup of these fermented tubes and comparing that to industry standards in the beer drinking world. Nobody in the lab actually drank any of the beer.
Because it might kill them?
Who knows? I mean, that's if it can suddenly taste completely differently, who knows what other chemical formations might occur?
Yeah, the whole what genes do get turned off has got me into a dark sci-fi. Like, now what happens when we try to grow fetuses? Because eventually we will have to procreate in space if humans keep going along the path we are.
Yeah, I have a feeling some of those first experiments are going to be accidental.
Yeah.
No one's going to condone a scientific experiment where they say, okay, we're going to deliberately get you pregnant in space. But someone's going to get pregnant in space because that's just how people are.
Yep.
So we'll find out.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right, from Cosmos. Did y'all know that soil is noisy?
Okay.
It is. And sound recordings can help us track soil health. Yeah, so Australian and Chinese ecologists stuck some microphones in the soil, and they found that soundscapes recorded from soil differ depending on its level of restoration. If this sounds familiar, we covered the coral reef ecosystem. Oh. Remember, like you play a track of healthy coral ecosystems and it kind of helped to rebuild them, and they're exploring that.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, lead author Dr. Jake Robinson, a microbial ecologist at Flinders University, said it's a bit of a rudimentary analogy, but we liken it to going to your GP when they put a stethoscope on your chest to look at your heartbeat and lungs. We're just doing a health assessment of the soil, but instead of heartbeat, it's the invertebrates in the soil that are making different sounds that we can detect. So what does it sound like? It's basically clicks and crackles and pops and little clicky sounds that these contact microphones can pick up.
Some skin crawling ASMRs.
I mean, yeah. It's a reflection of all the little worms and beetles and the ants and spiders.
And if you tickle someone while that's happening.
Now, they've been trialing these soil ecoacoustics in a few different locations, including agricultural sites in the UK and restoration sites in South Australia. The plots were at varying levels of degradation. Two had recently been cleared. Two had been cleared and revegetated 15 years ago. And two were remnant vegetation, so au naturel. What they found was that both the revegetated and reference state sites had a much more diverse soundscape than the degraded soil. Right now, they are trialing playing sounds to soil, right? The same way that we have in the coral reefs to see if that can, you know.
Right, draw the bugs in with more bug noises.
Exactly. And they're also using detection plates to help identify which invertebrates are present from their sounds. And according to pilot studies, they've shown they can detect the difference between things like millipedes versus ants, worms, and snails. And the quote here is great. You can compare, for instance, a millipede with its 1,000 legs tapping on the soil versus the slimy, glidey motion of a snail.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of playing bug sounds for the bugs to be drawn in, because also, like, that has the makings of a great horror movie where you're just constantly hearing bugs that aren't there. And it turns out the whole thing was just a bunch of scientists left some acoustic players out there that are deliberately playing bug noises, but you're having full-on hallucinations and running screaming out of the woods because of it.
Oh, except they're not hallucinations, because if you play them long enough, the bugs will come.
That's right.
And revitalize the soil, of course, not torture you.
That's right.
You know.
Sure.
Next link.
So I don't mean to cause panic, or you may have heard this on the news already, but this comes from Ars Technica. Town urges curfew over mosquito spread disease that kills up to 50% of people.
Oh my God.
This is actually a cautionary one. So a small town in Massachusetts is urging residents to stay indoors.
This is in Massachusetts?
Yeah, in the Michigan area too. They got a lot of mosquitoes up there too. Oh. And it's kind of gets swampy up there.
Oh.
So the virus causes Eastern Equine Encephalitis, EEE, which kills between 30 and 50% of people who are stricken.
Oh my gosh.
Those are often going to be children under the age of 15 and the elderly. Around half who survive are permanently left disabled.
Wow.
So far, one person in the town, an elderly resident in Oxford, has already become seriously ill. The virus is spread by mosquitoes in certain swampy areas of the country, particularly in the Atlantic and Gulf Coast states and the Great Lakes regions.
Yeah, I figure if we can get West Nile here, we can get this here. I mean, that's scary.
Mosquitoes shuttle the virus between wild birds and animals, including horses and humans. But also, I had to look this up. It's a dead end once it gets to humans and horses. So, like, if you're infected with it and a mosquito bites you, it's not going to carry it to somebody else.
Okay.
But it does with birds. So it'll go between birds and then it'll stop with horses and humans. But here's the good news. In humans, the virus causes very few cases in the U.S. each year. On average, 11, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Given the extreme risk of EEE, health officials take any spread seriously. So on August 16th, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health announced the state's first case and declared a critical risk level in the four communities of Douglas, Oxford, Sutton, and Webster. The recommendation is for residents to avoid mosquitoes' peak activity time. They should, quote, finish activities between September 30th and October 1st until the first hard frost. So stay out during peak mosquito times.
Or stay in during.
That's right. Stay in. Yes.
Right. Or stay out of Massachusetts entirely, which is what I plan to do.
Right. Wear lots of insect repellent, wear protective clothing, mosquito proof your homes.
And it was evening. Dusk is the worst time, they said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, officials emphasize that the curfew is a recommendation, not mandatory, because sure, we know how we like that.
Yeah, yeah.
However, to use town properties such as recreational fields, people will first need to file an indemnification form to provide proof of adequate insurance coverage to the town. They will not be held accountable.
Yeah, you got to pay for it.
To date, there have only been 3 cases of EEE in the U.S. this year, one in Massachusetts, one in Vermont, and the last in New Jersey. All 3 are neuroinvasive.
Yeah.
We've seen this before, though. In 2019, there was a multi-state outbreak of EEE, leading to a high of just 38 cases.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the nice things about diseases that have such a high death rate is it's really hard for them to spread very quickly. Mm-hmm. But still, that's incredibly unnerving.
Yeah.
Because it's like the apex predator PTSD.
Yep.
Like, you could get stung by a mosquito at any point and not even see it coming. Yeah. And so now you're just watching over your shoulder all the time. Yeah, okay, all right. I need to go join Mosquito Bite Club and like... All right, well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include electrostatic motors reach the macro scale, gay animals more common than you would think, and fake watermelons full of drugs fail to fool U.S. agents. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at Patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.